Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Daniel Pink. Daniel is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers on work, business, and psychology. His books have won multiple awards and have been translated into 39 languages. Dan was also host and co-executive producer of Crowd Control, a National Geographic TV series about human behavior. Hey, Dan, it's great to have you on Cool Tools.
I am so glad to be on Cool Tools. I'm a longtime Cool Tools fan, a longtime Recommendo fan, and I'm just delighted that I, at the end of this episode, I get my membership card.
Yeah, you'll be member 3.
Okay, well, I'll take it.
Very cool, Dan. So we're going to just jump right into it, and then
sure.
we'll talk a little bit about a new book that you have out. But let's just get started and tell us about these earplugs that you like.
Oh, man. Okay. So let me make the case for earplugs first, okay? Because okay. we'll go from like the genus to the species, all right? So so I'm a big fan of earplugs because I find that I work a lot better if I just block out sound. And a lot of times what will happen if you have like even like expensive noise canceling headphones, the battery will run out or you'll forget them, or I will actually always worry about losing them. And so I buy this box of earplugs. They come in these small individually wrapped pairs, and I use them for everything. I work in the garage behind my house. It's a pretty quiet office, and I still wear earplugs most days in my office. There's something to me that when you put in earplugs, it just blocks out the rest of the world and signals that you're in it.
So you're not a music guy then. You don't fill your ears with music.
Not when I work. No. Occasionally, well, I'll tell you what I do because I'll give you the height of my perversity. All right, here we go. So I like silence. All right. I like bathing in silence or near, you know, something close to silence. And some of it has to do with there's actually interesting research out here. So out there on this. I don't want to go off on a major tangent here, but let me go off on a minor one. So when we think about introversion and extroversion, the conventional view of that, which has been hammered into us by Myers-Briggs, which is an assessment that has zero scientific basis to it, is that it's about like, where do you get your energy from? Where do you get your energy from? You know, do you get it from other people? Do you get it from yourself? Da, 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 da. And that's just, and when there's a whole line of research in personality psychology about extroversion and introversion. And the scale that they use there, which has been validated repeatedly for decades in the world of psychological science, is that the more important measure of introversion and extroversion is how you deal with stimulus. That is, do you like a lot of stimulus around you all the time, or do you want minimal stimulus? And I tend to be a little bit bipolar on that. But when it comes to certain things, I like just being in a sealed chamber. And so the earplugs put me in a sealed chamber. So I very rarely listen to music when I work. I will listen to music, but not when I'm working. And I'll do something, but here, let's go back to my perversity here for a moment, because I know your legions of listeners were waiting for that. So let's suppose that I'm on an airplane. All right. Now, one of the things that bothers me about airplanes is that people talk. All right? They have every right to talk. It just bothers me. It's not a legitimate complaint. It's just a complaint. And I don't like hearing other people talk when I'm trying to read or do work. So what I will do is I will put in my earplugs. But on airplanes, I will put in my earplugs. And then over my ears, I will put my very expensive Bose noise canceling headphones. All right. So I'm not even done, guys. All right.
There's a dome of silence over that, right?
No, I put my noise canceling headphones over the earplugs that are my ears, which already have earplugs in them. But sometimes I'm so annoyed by just simply at some level, just knowing that other people around me are talking, that I will actually, I have a playlist on Spotify of white noise. So I will plug into white noise. So I have like this triple seal, have this triple seal around me. And I find that absolutely delightful. But the starting block, the center of it all, the fundamental unit in this universe are these earplugs. They're also really good. They're also really, really good in travel. So I basically keep a fistful of them in my backpack. They're very good in hotels too, because a lot of times in hotels, it's like, oh, I have the room next to the clanging ice machine. Oh, I have, you know, the room next to the elevator, and there are 3,000 Kiwanis from Buffalo drinking all night and coming in late at night, you know? And so, anyway, all of which is to say that, I don't have many friends, but I have a lot of earplugs.
So the cool tools follow-up question is, you're really passionate about earplugs, and, I assume you've tried every single variety or brand.
Yes.
And why are these your recommended variety?
Okay. I'm so glad you asked that question, because you know what? I didn't realize until we started it, but this is a conversation I've been wanting to have for years, because no one has ever asked me about this. So I'll tell you why. Number one of the things about earplugs is what they're made out of. All right. And so certain kinds of earplugs to me are too hard. All right. They're too stiff. They're not pliant enough to really work into your ear canal. All right. My wife will probably like divorce me, and my kids will disown me after hearing like the, you know, this whole conversation, like this obsessive approach to earplugs. But anyway, so part of it is are they moldable? Are they pliant? And these are very good in that regard. The other thing, believe it or not, is that earplugs do come in sizes. These end up being the right, so you want the right material, you want the right size. The other thing here is also that you have earplugs out there for sale that you often see on like construction sites and people operating heavy equipment that have they're corded. All right. So there's a cord, so you can kind of drape them around your neck and then put them in as necessary. And the thing about that is that adding to my appeal, is that I'm a slight germaphobe, so I like them in the individually wrapped two-pack. So when I use them, I can just immediately throw them away. You have earplugs for sale out there that will come with like a little carrying case, and so you can use them. I like the disposable ones, and I like that they're sealed in these little plastic packets, so I know that when I reach into my backpack, that I'm going to get a clean pair of earplugs.
Well, no, you don't have to answer this question, but are you a small, medium, or large ear canal?
Oh, that's now we're asking questions that require personal revelation that I'm not always comfortable with. I am proud to admit that I have a relatively large ear canal.
So Dan, one question I want to ask is, Tim Ferriss, we had him on the show a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He recommended these kind of like waxy, almost like a caramel type earplug that you push into your, it's silicone and it seals your ear. I have odd shaped ear canals. They're not like round. And for me, we went to Vancouver and we stayed at a really noisy Airbnb, and I put these in and it was like, oh my God, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
Have you tried those? And why don't you like those?
Okay. Well, number one, first, of course I've tried those, because, I have tried those. They're not bad. I actually have relatively conventional shaped ear canals. So I think if you have oddly shaped ear canals, that moldability, which the ones that I'm recommending are not moldable. They're pliant in a way, but they're not perfectly configurable. One of the things about those is that I felt that at some level they were a little too tight. I felt that they were sort of vacuum packed. And I found that the feel of it was like going up in an elevator very fast. I felt like there was kind of like pressure there that I didn't want.
Yeah, I could see that.
But listen, when it comes to, you know, I'm an open-minded earplug fanatic. So if people find the earplugs that are right for them, who am I to judge?
Yeah. You know, I was going to say earlier, this sounds like almost like a Michael Ian Black routine or something. You could be like
well, yes. Well, there you go. So I don't know. Maybe I have a future in middle tier stand up comedy.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. So this is something I've never heard of. I'm really excited to hear about it.
Because, yeah. What's that?
The jumbo grip pencils.
Oh. Okay. Good. Okay. So I'm less obsessive about this, but I'm still mildly obsessive about it. So over time, I'm not sure how it happened. I really like using pencils. I still, you know, as a writer, as a note taker, I find maybe it's delusional that I find that I think better if there's some tactile element to what I'm doing. So this is why I prefer to take. I almost never take notes by computer, but on my laptop, I prefer to take notes by hand. And there's actually some evidence that that aids in retention. But I just did it because I like the tactileness of it. I like the tactileness of paper. When I read on paper and underline on paper, I always have a sense of where I am. I have a sense of how the thing that I'm reading is structured in a way that I wouldn't if I simply read it electronically. But I started using pencils. And I love pencils. I love the sound of pencil on a paper, the scraping that it makes. I like the way that it looks. I tend to doodle and sketch a fair bit. And so it's much better than pens for that, because pens often have that little dollop of ink sometimes that will go on in there. And as I've experimented with pencils, there's a really cool pencil store. It's called something like CW Pencil or something like that. Mm-hmm. That somebody hit me to. It's basically a place. Yeah, CW Pencils. I order pencils through. I have no commercial connection to them. I order pencils through them.
So it's online site.
Yeah, CW okay. Pencil Enterprises. I think, shockingly enough, it's based in Brooklyn. So I ordered pencils through there, and I experimented with a bunch of different kinds of pencils. And the ones that I settled on were these things called Jumbo Grip Faber-Castell pencils. And what they are is that they actually, the barrel is thicker than a typical kind of number two pencil. That's one thing about it. So the barrel is thicker. So again, for me at least, it has that tactileness to it. The other thing about it is that the barrel isn't really a barrel. It's not in the shape of a cylinder, as most pencils are. It's actually in the shape of sort of a rounded triangle. And so it's bigger in diameter, and it's a different shape. And it also has these things, and I don't know what to call them. They're like little, there's like a line of small raised plastic dots that are akin to Braille in their texture. And what they do is they allow actually a firmer grip. And it turns out that I just stumbled on these pencils on my own. It turns out they're often used in elementary schools, these pencils, for like, you know, first graders, second graders, especially boys who struggle a little bit with fine motor skills, because it gives them some little bit more heft, a little bit more grip. But I ordered these pencils by the case, and I sharpen them and I grind them. I mean, literally, no joke. I'm literally holding one right now. So I love these pencils, and they're totally cheap.
And because they're wider diameter, do they still fit into a pencil sharpener, your ordinary pencil sharpener, or do you need to have a jumbo pencil sharpener?
I actually have I have it now in my, I'm here in my left hand, the Faber-Castell pencil sharpener. I prefer manual sharpeners to electronic electric sharpeners. And this one is called the Color Grip Universal Pencil Sharpener. So it actually has an opening that is big enough for these kinds of pencils. But this is like a tiny little, this pencil sharpener is maybe, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's basically smaller than my palm. In its height, and maybe 6 centimeters diameter. And it costs, you know, it costs a few bucks. This is a very, you know, this is not an expensive indulgence. This is just my own peculiar predilection.
I know that there are religious feelings about pencils. There are the sketchers, the people who yeah. sketch. And I know, Mark, I think you're a pencil user. Is that right?
Yeah, I like the Blackwing pencils.
Oh, that's a good pencil. I know that pencil. I might even have one here. That is a solid pencil. I admire your, you have a strong pencil game, Mark.
but he should maybe consider upping his game with a little bit fatter, more, the jumbo version.
It depends. I mean, Mark has much greater artistic abilities than I do. So he might need to rely on that. That one, if I'm not mistaken, Mark, it has an eraser on the top of it, right?
It does.
It has sort of like a rectangular-ish. Yeah.
That's cool.
eraser on top of it. Yeah. And I actually, this one does not have an eraser on it. And I actually don't use erasers all that much. I do a lot of like crossing out and things like that. And again, for whatever, you know, and I don't think this is that unique. I mean, there are people, you know, like artists, people who are designers and things that is, you know, moving a pencil around a page is it, whether you're writing words or whether you're drawing diagrams is a way to think. And so that's what I like about it. So that the tactileness is like, hey, it's like I feel like it triggers something in my brain that when the pencil is sliding across the paper, it's making that beautiful, delicious sound. It's leaving that residue of graphite that to me, it's like, oh, I'm activated in some way that my brain is really working.
Yeah. I love that triangular cross section too. It's just really cool looking.
Yeah, it's cool looking and it feels good. It's just, you know, I mean, at some level, it's like, I mean, as odd as it sounds, I'm like not a big car guy at all. But like some people have like strong preferences for cars. Oh, wow, this car drives so well. And to me, like, I'm kind of car blind to that. It's like, okay, it's a car. I'm not really seeing massive differences here. And for me, the pencils are like a car. It's like, ooh, have you driven the BMW pencil? Have you driven the Mercedes pencil? You know, and for me, This is the luxury touring sedan of pencils.
Yeah, I agree. And so just to get the price down, it's like $18 for a dozen, and then the sharpener is another $6. And
so, is that what it is? Good. Yeah. Thanks for looking that up. Yeah, I knew it was a few bucks. So this is not an expensive purchase at all. This is not, you know, this is in some ways like the Honda Accord, I guess, of pencils.
With your pencil habit and your earplug habit, you're a cheap date.
I am. Well, you know what? Here's the thing. You two can understand this because we're all self-employed here. It's I've been self-employed for over 20 years now and, you know, low overhead, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. So
low overhead is the secret to happiness in life.
Yeah.
That's isn't that Dickens' advice?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. It could have been St. Augustine.
Yeah. So moving on to something a little more expensive,
yes.
but still, it's so funny, Dan, that you mentioned this because yesterday I was just at this website looking and thinking how the hell do they get all these big name experts? It's Masterclass is what it's called. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a new one, and this is the most expensive thing on my list. I think that let me explain what it is. And there's a yearly fee. It's just south of $200. But MasterClass is a set of classes, but classes conducted by like the best people in the world at what they do. I mean, and that's not like an exaggeration. So if you look at, you know, basketball skills, they have Steph Curry. If you look at screenwriting, they have Aaron Sorkin. You look at acting, they have Helen Mirren. They have a lot of writers. Comedy, they have Steve Martin. Filmmaking, they have independent filmmaking, they have Mira Nair. You know, they just signed up. I just got an email today. They have you know, about guitar. Who's teaching guitar? Carlos Santana.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
Music scoring, Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, right. And so what this is, it's very, very well produced. And so what they are is it's a series of classes, But the classes are more like interviews. They're not as purely didactic as somebody standing in front of a class and telling you precisely how to do something, or at least the ones that I've watched and enjoyed. But you get to see people who are really, really great at something explain how they do it. And as I said, it's very well produced, and they're divided into videos that are made. They vary in length, but the videos can be anywhere from 3 minutes to sometimes 20 minutes. And they're divided into certain, you know, sections based on what the person is trying to teach. So even things like Helen Mirren has a very short video about how to walk onto a stage, something that you wouldn't think about, but that you're like, whoa, that's actually a big thing. Like, how do you walk onto a stage if you're an actor? Mm-hmm. And again, there's something for, you know, and I think it's really, really good because I've watched pieces of some. So some of them were better than others. But I watched the entire thing, Aaron Sorkin on screenwriting, which was fabulously interesting. And he actually took clips from movies and things and showed about, you know, basically dissected it in front of you. He also did this thing in that class where he had some actual students who were writing screenplays and he gave them feedback on what they were doing. Margaret Atwood has one about novel writing that was fantastic, just because you're like, watch, like, you know, you're on your phone, or, you know, you're sitting around in the back of a cab or something like that. And it's like, hey, Margaret Atwood is talking to you. It's super cool. There's another really good one that just came up by James Suckling, the wine critic, on, you know, how do you understand wine? And so for me, for, I think it's like 180, 190 bucks a year, for it's all you can eat sessions with these great people. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, the price is not that bad. And I wonder, like, why would Steve Martin do this when he's like already has all the money he wants? It takes a long time. These are really high quality videos. Are they doing it just because they want to like share what they know? I'm sure they're getting paid something.
But they are getting paid. And I actually looked into this. Mm-hmm. They get paid a very high flat fee, mm-hmm. And then they get some kind of royalty based on views. But what you also have here is you have people who are not always, but you have people who are. I think that it's people who do want to basically share their craft in a way, because you have people who are. I would say half the instructors are over age 60. So mm-hmm. you have somebody like Steve Martin. He's been at this for a very, very, very long time, and he's sharing his secrets. Or you have investigative journalism with Bob Woodward. Okay, Bob Woodward's in his 70s. Or David Mamet. I mean, I have this on my list. I haven't seen that. Like, David Mamet is teaching dramatic writing. You know, and David Mamet must be, I don't know, David Mamet must be, you know, in the 70s as well.
Yeah. And Scorsese. So,
he's And, but they also have, you know, but what I like is the breadth too, because they have cooking stuff. I'm not like a big cooker kind of person. So, but they have chefs and things like that. They have some actors. They have a lot of writers. That's pretty easy to do. But they have, you know, Serena Williams teaches tennis. Annie Leibovitz teaches photography.
Yeah.
It's cool.
You have Ken Burns.
Yeah, Ken Burns is, they do have that. So he must be teaching like documentary filmmaking or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So So for a year of all you can watch, this would probably be a fantastic, never ending stream, because obviously they're going to continue to add people.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well. And so you could probably never run out of really great stuff. Just having a conversation is one thing. I haven't watched any of these, but it would be really interesting, and hopefully they could actually see people. I think you can learn a lot from watching someone do something, actually doing what they're doing or teaching. That would be really great if they were able to incorporate that into it over time.
Yeah, I think that they have. You have that in. I think they have that pretty clearly in the cooking.
Well, of course,
But even what I think is interesting, even in the wine tasting. Not the wine tasting, but the class on wine with James Suckling, the wine critic, is like even things like how do you hold a glass to examine the color of a wine, and it turns out like, okay, not that I did it a lot, but anytime I did do it, I was doing it completely wrong. And so seeing him demo that, I like the stuff on, I mean, because I'm a writer, I like the writing stuff, but the stuff, the things by actors are very, very interesting because you realize, you know, like how you move your body, it conveys so much in a way that people, you know, who live in their head most of the time don't always grok. So, I think it's a great investment. I mean, I think it'd make a super cool gift too.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Okay.
So you said you're not much of a cooker, but your last one is actually a kitchen tool.
It is, but it's an awesome kitchen tool. And and in my household, I'm not much of a cooker, but if it involves cooking outside, that's my domain. Mm-hmm. And I have two domains in cooking. One of them is anything involving grilling, and the other one, which we won't talk about, is we have nothing in the house. There's no way we can come up with a dinner based on the ingredients in our house. Wait, just wait. Let me show you. The grilling is, we have a little grill in our backyard, and in my house we have, I have two kids in college now, but when they're back and I got we have varying eating proclivities here. So we have some people who don't eat meat, and then one person who's allergic to fish, and it's just a whole crazy thing going on. But we managed to square it. And so we've ended up grilling a lot of fish because we have three people in my house who don't eat meat. And so we end up grilling fish. And fish is actually really hard to grill because it doesn't hang to, obviously it's very different in consistency from a beef steak, you know, a piece of beef. It's certain kinds of fish, particularly certain kinds of salmon, are very, very fatty. That's one of the things that makes it so good. But it creates all kinds of oil and flames and things like that. And a lot of times the fish, particularly when you cook it on the skin side, it sticks. And I was always frustrated. And somehow, I think it was my wife found this spatula that is the greatest spatula I've ever seen. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, it is so great. And so all of a sudden I'm able to up my grill game significantly because of the spatula, which is, I don't know, maybe it's like a $25, $30 spatula. And what it is that the way it sort of has this beveled edge to it, and it has this handle, and it's like exactly the right level of flexibility. And so you can get underneath the fish in a way you can't with a regular spatula. And it has some give, so you can actually, with a fair amount of confidence, say, take a hamburger or something like that and literally like flip it in the air, which I think, I mean, I grill by myself, like nobody ever accompanies me and talks to me when I grill, so I just do it for my own kicks. But, you know, and so it has this kind of, it's almost like if you think about a piece of sports equipment, and no matter what your sport is, there's certain kinds of sports equipment that feel right. It's like, oh my God. There are all these tennis rackets out there, but this tennis racket, I feel like I hit a lot better. There are all these baseball bats out there. I feel like I hit better with this baseball bat. There are all of these, mitts for playing softball. And this one somehow fits my hand. And this is just a great, great, it's a great, great spatula. And this is the first time in my life I've been excited by a kitchen tool. That's why I wanted to share it with the millions of people on Cool Tools.
Now, I see that there are other spatulas that have the same kind of general design, which is called slotted. They're like five or six long. It's a long spatula with slots in the center of it, like maybe five of them.
Yeah,
and they seem to be a thing called a fish spatula. Which
yes, it's exactly what it is. Yeah, I should have been clear on that. Yeah, right. It's designed for fish, and I don't know how they figured this out.
Right.
But it has, yeah, I should be clear here. So it's not a single sheet of metal. It is, well, it might be a single sheet of metal, but it has five long slots carved out. It's actually a peculiar shape because it's, I don't even know what shape I would call it. It's like some kind of...
It's like a foot shape almost. Or not.
It is. It does have a kind of a foot shape to it. It really does. It looks like a foot in a way. I never noticed that before. It looks like a foot with a handle. So it's the shape of it. So it isn't perfectly rectangular. It actually doesn't have right angles anywhere on it. in the contrast to many kinds of spatulas. And for whatever reason, like somebody, some designer somewhere, or some mechanical engineer, or maybe just some civilian who is obsessed about grilling fish, figured out a way to come up with literally the ideal fish spatula. So if you grill fish at all, this is perfect. I mean, it's just a great, great product. And the brand name is kind of cool too, because it's called Hell's Handle by Mercer.
Cool. I love that name.
Yeah.
And so there's, okay, yeah, there's just one. Well, there does. Okay. There's just one size. All right.
Actually, I think that there are. Yeah, there's only one size of the fish spatula. Fish, yeah. And I think that they literally like have. I don't know anything about this company. I've done no due diligence on how it came to be, but it works so well for this task. And that itself is a beautiful thing, right? When you have something that is like, there's this one job that this product, this device has to do, and it does it perfectly. It does it better than anything else. I mean, that's in some ways a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I love that.
It is. So if you're into fish, this is it. This is the Turner for you.
Yeah. And it's like 35. It's $35, but
it'll last forever.
It seems like one of those things that lasts forever. There's no planned obsolescence or anything baked into it. It's just,
if you use something every day, price is like not one of the most important considerations.
I figure if I amortize it over five to seven years of grilling fish, it probably saves me money in salmon not destroyed.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and good salmon's expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about your book, When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Sure. So that's a book that came out in January of 2018. I wrote it because I was making all kinds of timing decisions in my own life. When should I do this kind of work? When should I do that kind of work? When should I start a project? When should I stop a project? And I was making the decisions in a very sloppy way. And I wanted to make them in a better way. And I started looking at, just out of curiosity, was there any research on timing? And it turned out there was an enormous amount of research out there on timing. Splattered across many, many, many domains. So there was research in economics and social psychology, but also in microbiology and in anesthesiology and in a whole field called chronobiology and in cognitive science. And all these researchers out there were asking very similar questions, but because they were in different fields, they weren't talking to each other. So I spent a couple of years just going through these papers over, you know, lots of literally 700 something papers to try to crack the code and come up with an evidence-based way to make better, smarter decisions about when to do things. So, you know, how do you configure your day in a smarter way? When should you be taking breaks? How do beginnings affect us? Some incredible stuff there. How do endings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do groups synchronize in time? How does the very way we think about time shape our behavior? So it's a science-based book with a lot of takeaways.
And what's an example of the way that this understanding and these insights has changed how you run your own life?
Oh, well, I mean, at one level, it changed the way I configured my schedule. What we know from this incredible body of research, especially just on the unit of a day, is that our cognitive abilities, our brain power, does not remain static over the course of a day. Our cognitive abilities change over the course of a day. They change in material ways. They can change sometimes in dramatic ways. And if you actually know how that is happening, you can do the right work at the right time. So I have actually reconfigured my daily schedule around this, particularly when it comes to writing, when it comes to certain kinds of pursuits that aren't about just locking down and getting stuff done, but that are about being a little bit more freewheeling and iterative. I take a lot more breaks now because I have a whole chapter on the science of breaks. The science of breaks is where the science of sleep was 15 years ago. It's about to crash through the surface. We know a lot more about why breaks matter, what kinds of breaks are most important. I've written six books, and this one has actually had a bigger effect on my day-to-day life than the other one. So anyway, it's a book about, you know, it's rooted in science, but it's what I'm trying to do is give people some tools and tips and takeaways so they can do things a little differently.
One quick question, Dan, about that. I've heard advice about like scheduling meetings. Somebody said, just try to do all your meetings for the week in one day and just have like a day of meetings. And then you have the rest of the week to actually do work. Is that something that you explored in the book, or what's your thought on that?
Not explicitly, but it's actually a really interesting. It's a very, very interesting point, because what you're talking about there, is intention and when we schedule meetings. And what typically happens in organizations is that there's no intention behind scheduling meetings. So we know that different people have different chronotypes. So some people do better early in the day, some people do it better later in the day. We know that certain times of day are better for analytic work. We know that certain times of day are better for creative work. And yet when it comes to scheduling meetings in organizations, we don't do that. We don't say, is this a good time of day for Mark? Is this a good time of day for Kevin? What kind of meeting is this? Do we want people to be locked down and focused? Do we want people to be more iterative and creative? Is this purely administrative? We don't ask those questions. We just say, hey, is Fred available? Is Maria available? And is conference room 3C open? I mean, there's no strategy and no intentionality behind it. So at least with that solution, there's some intentionality behind it. And so having all your meetings on one day, I think it's worth experimenting with. I think the most important thing is to be intentional and deliberate about scheduling meetings when the science tells us people are more likely to perform at their highest level.
Yeah, and I think one of the future directions is that you would come of age at some point and have a better idea for yourself of like what works for you and what doesn't, because most people, including me, don't have a very good idea because we have never been taught that. We haven't been trained or tested. And so I could see us kind of, like you were talking about personality types. Well, you really kind of want to know your chronotype.
Absolutely.
I don't know my chronotype. And it would be so valuable to me if I did. So is
absolutely. Totally. I mean, I'll be your hallelujah chorus here on that one. You absolutely should.
Yeah.
And even more broadly, you know, we don't do a very good job of observing our own behavior. And you know, if we're a little bit more observant of our own behavior, we can make small moves that can make us, you know, get more stuff done and be a little bit happier.
Do you outline in your book a simple procedure for determining your chronotype?
Yeah, there's some good assessments that are available online. One of them is called the Munich Chronotype Questionnaire, the MCTQ. There's another one called the Morning Eveningness Questionnaire, the MEQ. But there's also actually, I read about many chronobiologists use a very simple back of the envelope calculation that I could do with you, Kevin. I mean, Liz, we can find your chronotype in 30 seconds if you want to do it.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. It's a cool tools first. here we go. Okay. So what I want you to think about. Okay. So here's a way to think about chronotypes. What we have, let me show you the distribution first of chronotypes. So we know about 15% of the population are very strong morning people, larks, naturally get up early, naturally go to sleep early. We know about 20% of the population are very strong owls, get up late, go to sleep late. And then we know about 2/3 of us are in the middle, what I call third bird. So here's what I want you to think about. I want you to think about what chronobiologists call a free day. This is important, a free day. A free day is a day you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock. You're not massively sleep deprived, so you're catching up on sleep. You can just go to sleep and wake up whenever you want. Naturally, the way your body tells you. So on a free day, what time would you typically go to sleep on a free day?
Go to sleep on a free day.
Yeah.
One.
And what time would you typically wake up?
7:30.
You're only getting 6.5 hours of sleep?
Yeah.
Jeez. All right. You need to sleep more, man.
No. I have a 20-minute nap in the afternoon.
Oh, naps are good.
Yeah.
Naps are, but I have a whole section on naps. there's the science of naps is quite fascinating. Yeah, naps are much better for us than I ever realized. Okay.
Yeah.
So 6.5 doesn't seem like a lot, but we can work with that. What we're trying to figure out here is your midpoint of sleep. So if you go to sleep at 1 and wake up at 6:30, your midpoint
is 7:30.
I'm sorry, 7:30. Your midpoint of sleep is 4:15. All right. So here's what we know. If your midpoint of sleep is before 3:30, you're probably a lark. If your midpoint of sleep is after 5:30, you're probably an owl. You fall pretty much dead in the middle. It's a very common chronotype. You're kind of in the middle. So for you, you're probably better off doing your analytic work early in the day, but not like it, ridiculously early, and your creative work later in the day, but not probably pulling an all-nighter.
Wow, that is so cool.
You're a third bird, Kevin.
That is so cool. I really want to read your book now.
I hope you do.
Yeah, no, I think this is like a whole world that I didn't know about, and it sounds so vitally important. And, why weren't we told about this before?
Tell me about it. That's what I've been doing. I'm sounding the time alarm here.
Okay.
I'm the Paul Revere of chronotypes.
You're doing a great job. And, I that was so elegantly simple. I get it. Okay. A very small calculation that could really inform how you could improve your life. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we'll include a link to that. And again, the book is called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, and it's by our guest today, Daniel Pink. Dan, thank you so much. This was a blast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to finally, after all these years, be part of the Cool Tools tribe.
Yeah, well, you awesome. Really outdid yourselves, and we look forward to doing this again.
All right, sounds good. Thank you both.